Welcome to Inspirational Tales. When my guests on this podcast experience the most challenging times of their lives, they use these hardships to learn, grow, and better themselves. And as a result, they are now thriving in life. Their stories are ones of resilience, strength, and overcoming adversity. So sit back and join me as we celebrate them turning their challenges into triumphs. My guest on this episode is Emma Money. Emma was born with cystic fibrosis and was not expected to live past her childhood, but she had other ideas. Now in her 30s, Emma joined me for a chat about her incredible life so far. As a baby, she was put up for adoption due to her diagnosis. She explains how her adoptive parents gave her the best possible start to life and how she came to meet her biological family purely by chance. Growing up, Emma didn't have any female role models with cystic fibrosis that she could look up to, so she set out to become that role model for others. Emma is now a mum of two beautiful children and created her platform CF Mummy to bring her community together and show that being a mum with cystic fibrosis is definitely possible. Emma is also a cystic fibrosis ambassador, an author, speaker, and model. She is a recipient of a number of awards, including being named the 2020 Australian of the Year South Australian Local Hero. Emma has pushed the boundaries of what she was told was possible for her, and as a result, is living an incredibly full life. Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today. How are you?
Hi, thank you. I'm very well. Just how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Very lovely to have you here today, finally. Took a little while to get together, but we worked it out in the end, which is good.
No, I'm glad I can be here. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to, having a chat with you today.
That's great. So today we are going to speak about your life and your journey with living with cystic fibrosis. Mm-hmm. But I would like if you could please start off by explaining to everyone listening who doesn't know what cystic fibrosis actually is.
Sure. Well, you can probably hear it in my voice. I sound very husky at the moment. Cystic fibrosis, to give you a bit of a background, is a lung disease. So it affects primarily the lungs and digestive system. But going back quickly to the husky voice, because I've been coughing so much the last couple of days, it's basically stripped the back of my throat, I feel, and I've been left with this hoarse voice. So I'm not sick, but I'm not 100% at the moment. To make it easy to understand, the mucus is a lot thicker and stickier in someone with cystic fibrosed lungs than someone like yourself, potentially, that doesn't have CF. So a simple cold can lead to a chest infection, which overall, eventually over time, causes constant lung damage and lung deterioration. So that's one element of CF. The other part of it is the digestive side of things. So for myself, my body doesn't produce enough pancreatic enzyme. So I need to take enzymes every day, every time I eat food, to help digest the food, to help break down what I'm eating. Otherwise, it just doesn't digest. So there's probably the two main parts of CF, but there are days, where I say to people, I just need to have a CF day because I'm just exhausted. And it is an invisible disability. Illness, disability. I mean, let's define what that is. I don't know. But for me, I think it's really easy to say, I have a life-threatening lung disease. Every 4 days in Australia, a baby is born with CF. And for those of you listening, might be completely unaware, but 1 in 25 Australians carry the CF gene and don't even realise.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's very common.
So when you say carry the gene, so do you carry one part of it, and then if two go together, you end up with the condition? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so then there's a 1 in 4 chance that their baby would have cystic fibrosis if you're both carriers.
Wow, and I'm presuming people don't know that, like if they're a carrier.
No, they don't. So it's not something you have symptoms for, but it can be tested. Like if you were going to go trying to have children, you can be tested to see if you're a carrier of the CF gene or not. But given the way the world is today, we are aware of so many conditions prior to babies being born. So having a genetic testing prior to, going through pregnancy for some people is quite a big deal in some regards. So both my parents were carriers and I had cystic fibrosis.
Is it common to actually get that genetic testing? Do you know?
It's starting to become more common now. Now that there's more of awareness around what cystic fibrosis is. When I was born in 87, and, that was probably not the greatest time to be born with CF. And if anyone listening was to Google CF, even now, you would see the average life expectancy is 37 years old. Yeah, I just turned 34 and I've got two children of 6 and an 8-year-old. So a life expectancy doesn't really sit right for me. But the more and more I'm learning with my community and, you know, the people that I speak to almost on a daily basis are somewhat impacted by CF, whether they've got a friend or a family member who's been diagnosed. Or I actually had a lady randomly tell me recently that she didn't realize she was a carrier, but it came from in the family. There was her sister who had children. So it's always, it's hard to know. So the children had CF, and then naturally the rest of the family got tested and realized who was actually a carrier. So I think the more awareness around what cystic fibrosis is, it is a serious lung disease, and it is very common here in Australia, that the genetic testing side of things probably is becoming a lot more of an option for people to choose to do that.
Oh, that's great. That's really good. I'm presuming back then it wasn't as common. And yeah, so you actually have a very interesting, I guess you'd call it, story about when you were born and you were put up for adoption by your parents because you had cystic fibrosis, but then you were adopted because you had cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
Your parents, your adoptive parents, sound absolutely incredible. Can you explain a bit about that, what happened, and why your parents, your now parents, decided to adopt you?
Yeah. Yeah. My story's a bit crazy, really. I still pinch myself thinking that's, look, this is a true story. Could make a movie about it.
Yeah, they should.
We did actually, it did go on the Australian Story years ago on the ABC, one portion of my story. But, you know, I'm not going to start off by going once upon a time, but it kind of is, you know, once upon a time I was born. My birth parents were new to Australia from Greece. And the knowledge of cystic fibrosis when I was born was very little. So for them to get to Australia, barely speaking English, find out that I had cystic fibrosis, I was diagnosed when I was born. Now, babies, when they're born with CF, there's a few common indicators. Now, there's a when babies are born straight away, they have to pass a poo, like tar-like poo. It's called meconium. Now, if a baby doesn't pass that at first when they're born, then you know straight away that they've got cystic fibrosis. Oh, that's a big indicator. So for me, that didn't happen. I actually still have a scar across my stomach from where I had to have a bag for that to go and happen. So when I was born, I probably had more digestive issues than I did CF issues. So I was born, that happened, I was diagnosed. The other part to know as well is all babies with CF were very salty, very, very salty. You could lick us and their salt is very high because we just seem to basically ooze salt out of us. We lose it very quickly. So there's a few tests. They can have their heel pricked as well when babies are born as part of the diagnosis. But it's diagnosed at birth once the baby's come out, unless you've had testing prior. So I was born. I was only a few days old, and they made the decision to give me up for adoption. And I went into a foster home not for very long. I was born in October, and by Christmas, I had my new mum and dad. Now, it's a weird one because, you know, I think, do I feel sad that I was given up for adoption? No. I was adopted by my mum and dad, two amazing people. Now, my dad is a paraplegic, and his story is incredible. But without going into too much of it, when they adopted me, dad at the time had one leg, one hip. You know, he was dialyzed 3 times a week from memory back then even. He had no kidneys, or he's got no kidneys, I should say. And they wanted to adopt a baby with a disability to show and give, well, not to show, but to give a child the life that others may be a bit scared, I guess, to do, and to just give a baby a normal life. So they adopted me. Now, my dad missed my first birthday. He was competing in the Seoul Paralympics in weightlifting. And I always say that because, you know, my dad has a very visible disability. I'm also very obviously adopted. He's a man of color. He's got dark skin, and I am a Greek girl. So we're very opposite looking. And so I've always known I was adopted, but I always speak of my dad and the strength and what he's gone through, because he's never let having a disability define him or stop him from living his life to the fullest. You know, he has been the most hands-on dad that I could imagine a dad to be in whatever that looks like. To then also go on, and I've got a brother and sister younger than I am, you know, to have a family, to have a very successful career despite being in a wheelchair, he has definitely taught me some very good foundations. And that's a big message I always like to share with people, that disability, whether it's visible or invisible, should not define you or who you are or what you do in this world, mm-hmm. because everyone is going through something. Everyone's got a story that you potentially know nothing about. And I think that's been embedded into me from the day, for as long as I can remember. Now, my mum, she's incredible. She's a nurse and, an amazing woman in her own right. And they say it's true, you know, until you become a parent yourself, you don't appreciate what your parents actually do for you. And my mum is just the rock of our family. And I just think there were times growing up that I would be in one hospital for 2 weeks having intravenous antibiotics. My dad would be in another hospital. Oh. And my mum would have my brother and sister, both young, as well as working herself. And she would hold that together for us all. So we are so lucky. We are so blessed in that way. So long story, but the short part of it, because I won't go into every detail of it, but I was only about 16. And I always, like I said, I've always known I'm adopted, been very obvious my entire life. And mum and dad have always been very open, even to the point I know who my foster parents are. They'd send me birthday cards and, you know, we'd visit them as I grew up and everything. And I knew a few details about my biological parents. Mum's always been very honest. And any questions, I've always had them answered to the best of their ability. Anyway, I remember just over a few months at one point having a dream about my birth mum. And I dreamt that she was coming into my room, sitting down on my bed and waking me up and wanting me to come out with her and meet everyone. And this was a reoccurring dream for a little while, and I didn't understand what it meant. Now, the woman that was coming into my room in my dream, it was her, and the vision I had of her was from a photograph that my mum and dad, like, we've got a few photos of me as a baby with my birth family. So I was seeing that picture, that woman come to life and come and get me. Anyway, I ended up finding where they lived in Adelaide. So they live not far from us as well, which is ironic. And thanks to the white pages and internet and technology, I was able to find where they lived and everything. But I didn't do anything about it at this point. I'm trying to think now back then what happened. So this is what happened. Before I actually did that bit, I missed the whole big chunky start, the chunky story. So I knew where they lived. I didn't know what I was going to do about it. I was only 15, 16, you know, at this point, and it was very much advised, get some counselling, because you need to probably work through, maybe they don't want you to contact them. Yeah. What if they don't want to talk to you? It's not going to be the happy ending. Now, I have a brother 4 years older than I am, and as a kid, all I ever wanted to do was meet my older brother. Anyway, I was out one evening, and it was the first time mum had let me out at an underage sort of nightclub, and I had one job, and that was to be home on time. Which I'm still never on time. It seems to be a reoccurring thing.
You were on time today.
I was on time today. Oh my gosh, we should all go buy a lottery ticket or go buy a scratchy or something, because I'm never on time, and it's an accident, and I'm not trying to be rude. It's just me. But this one night I was late, and I ended up, it sounds like a really dodgy story, but I promise it's not. I was a young, 16-year-old girl. I was with two of my girlfriends. I'd had a guy friend, and he was just a friend. Everyone says, was it your boyfriend? No. Had a guy friend who acted like a brother to me and sort of said, my mate can drop you and the girls home, because I'd missed the train. And I thought, oh, my gosh, riding in cars with boys, that's how it sounded. Didn't know the guy driving. It was about a half an hour drive from my house, and I thought, you know what, we're doing it. So I got in the car with my girlfriends. My friend, he sat in the front, and the driver, he was quite a bit older, but he kept looking at me in the revision mirror. And as we were driving, I started to feel a little bit uncomfortable. And then he questioned who I was, like, and why was I out so late? And I was very confused, and he had mistaken me for somebody else and apologized. Anyway, he asked me what nationality I was, and I said I was Greek. And he started talking in Greek to me, and I said, oh, no, I don't talk Greek. And he said, how do you call yourself a wog if you can't even speak it? And I looked and I thought, oh, well, we've got time. I can tell you the story. I was given up for adoption, and this is what happened. Now, I did miss this detail out. After I was given up for adoption, my birth father told the family that I had passed away. So my brother, 4 years older than I am, and my birth mum believed that I had died.
So they didn't know that you were given up for adoption at all. It was just your dad.
Well, I've learned since that two parties need to give approval in order to give the adoption for that to go ahead. So they were both aware, but then my birth mum was told a few weeks after they'd given me up for adoption, the baby died.
Oh.
So whilst I'm driving and telling this guy, he's pulled over because I told him my name because it wasn't Emma, and told him the names of my family members, biological family members. He could not believe it. He had been to Greece with my brother the year before and remembers my brother losing a sister, and remembers and was telling me that every year on the 17th of October, my birthday, they would light candles for the baby that died. So you can imagine the shock from his end.
Yeah, how is that to find out that they all thought you were dead?
I knew that. It's funny because we also, when things are traumatic in our life, we sort of forget details. So I don't remember 100%, you know, the ins and outs of what went down there. But what I do remember is he called my brother. It was about midnight on the phone, and my brother was extremely angry at me and told me I was a sicko, basically, you know, for trying to get him believing that his sister was alive. He remembers she died. And then I gave him some examples of who I was and why I was who I was. And he was shocked. I still got paintings from him from when I was a baby, and he was doing them in kindy saying, get well soon. So anyway, that happened. And then that sort of was put to bed, in the sense that it didn't really, nothing came of it. But my mission was like, he's here, I need to find them. So that's where we go back to what I was saying before, you know, thanks to the internet and all the information I knew, I found them. And what I did is I wrote a letter to my birth brother first and then my birth mother. So they got it a day apart, and I explained who I was and that I wanted to meet them and why I wanted to meet them. And basically, yeah, that I'm here. The day that my birth mum got her letter, I was actually in the local paper here in Adelaide, and the title was Beating Illness Should Be in Fashion. And I was only 16, and it was the first big spread I'd done as a fashion model. And it was about showcasing, you know, the spring launch of spring wear, spring fashion. But I was so proud because I thought I've made it, you know, it was a local paper, but I'd made it as a model, and CF wasn't going to define me. So that article came out, and it was a couple of pages of a spread. And the day that came out, my birth mum, that letter, she received it. And my brother called me that night and said she knew straight away that it's you. So that was midweek. And by that Friday night, I've got my entire family meeting them. Now, rewind to my brother. He rang me. I was on the way to, you know, when you get your license and you're young, you just like to go for drives and cruises through Hungry Jack's and things like that. And my girlfriend and I had our trackies on and big hoodies on and whatever, and we were driving, and I get this phone call a couple of days after the – well, that was the Wednesday. And it was literally like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday sort of thing. That was the Wednesday night, and I get this phone call on the way down. We're driving down a hill, and this guy – I answer, this guy says, is this Emma? And I said, yeah, it is. He goes, well, it's your brother. And I nearly, like, I now know why we're not allowed to drive with our phones in our hand or while talking, because I nearly had a crash. And I thought, he wanted to meet me then and there. And I thought, I can't meet him. Like, I'm not dressed. I look daggy. I'm just out for a little night cruise. But I ended up going to meet him with my girlfriend. And I will never forget that day when I got out of the car. We just went to a petrol station of all places. I got out of the car, and there was a car between us, and all I could see was his eyes. And it still gives me goosebumps, because I just remember thinking, that's him. I've never had someone who looks like me before. My brother and sister look nothing like me, but he's my blood brother. And holy crap, like, he's got my eyes. And then the car reversed, and then I saw the rest of him, and he's very tall. And yeah, it was very emotional. Questioned me the way I thought a true wog boy would. And we get our our ideas of, you know, what people are like from movies and whatnot. But he straight away was the protective big brother, questioning me about everything and anything, and had a bit of a giggle. And then, yeah, by the end of that week, my entire family met my birth family. And let's just say, cat's out of the bag, that I'm not passed away. And yeah, it was definitely a very challenging time.
What's the chance, though, that happened? And that you got into that car with that guy who knew them. Like, that's unbelievable.
So he thought I was my sister, my biological sister, who's 14 months younger than I am.
Oh, okay.
So
you look very similar.
We look very similar. And that's who he thought I was. So you can imagine when I'm there like, oh, that's not me.
Yeah.
You know, how shocked he was. I still think, how the hell did that happen? Like, yeah. That just does not happen to people. But it does. Look at my story.
Did you find out why your biological dad said that you had passed away?
Yeah, I've asked him. So fast forward to now, I have a relationship with him and not the other side, which is bizarre because people would often think you should hate him for what he did and he's lied to the family. He knew I was alive all these years. But I don't have any hate. If I wasn't given up for adoption, I'd probably be dead in reality. I've learned a lot about having a mum and dad, a dad in a wheelchair. I've learned a lot about disability, diversity, resilience, overcoming adversity, like life. You know, I wouldn't have had that. So I'm grateful, but I've asked him why. Why did you do it? Like, and he said that she was suffering and every day was her suffering and her baby was gone. So he had to do what he thought was the right thing to protect her and say the baby died. So giving me up, I asked her as well when I met them. And as a mum now, I probably wouldn't make it an excuse for her, but you know, my heart still is probably broken in some ways with that. As a mother, I don't understand how a baby, I don't understand this thing, but I've grown up in a family with love and support. So, you know, I would not have that even in my mind to give a baby up for adoption. But for them, they didn't have family here. This baby was going to die anyway. They were putting me in the place that was best for them. And that was just heartbreaking. So for my birth mum, as I questioned her, she was just traumatized and yeah, really horrible. So that I never really got answers from her, but for him it was I did what I had to do to protect her. And rightfully or wrongfully, like, I think that's okay, you know. I was never coming back to them, but he needed to do what he needed to do in order for her to get maybe closure. But since, you know, only even five well not even years only years ago, my brother actually told me he remembers his mum driving past memorial sites looking for my where I was. And he remembers that as a young kid. Now, I've got a six-year-old with a very, very creative imagination. And the things my little one remembers, I think, it's heartbreaking. So it's probably still quite a raw thing, something I'll probably forever have not all the answers because it wasn't the happy ending that I thought it would be. But I found them and I'm grateful for that. And I have a relationship with my birth father and it's a hard one. Like I said, heart still is broken in some ways from it, but I've got a beautiful family and I'm very blessed in that way.
Yeah, it sounds like your adoptive parents were perfect for you and they gave you the best upbringing possible to get to where you are now. So I guess it did kind of work out. But yeah, sounds like it's really difficult what happened, but yeah.
It's a tricky one. And I'm always like, oh, yeah, that did actually happen. But, you know, we can't really dwell on what could have been.
Yeah.
I know what could have been. I would have really been in a grave. And that's very morbid. But, yeah, we all go through things in life that I guess shape us. And at the time, you don't understand why. And now, even just sitting here talking out loud about it again, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I'm all right with it because it's made me the person I am today. And I'm now able to use my story to, you know, open up maybe a conversation for somebody or maybe someone's listening that is adopted or has something similar have happened. And if I can be vocal about it to an extent, it might just create a little bit of a awareness for others in their own worlds, you know, the counselling side of it. Should I have gone and had counselling? Who knows? But it is what it is. It happened. And I can now use my stuff, hopefully, to help people in a positive way. And we all go through things differently, but it does shape us, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So you said that you weren't expected to live.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And how were you able to be here today talking to me?
Yeah, good question. No one's ever asked me that. So very good. I'm like, oh, now I've got to think about that one. No, so I think with cystic fibrosis, growing up, like for me, for example, I always say this, when I was about six and I had the first funeral to go to as a six-year-old.
For someone with CF?
Another girl had CF. She was 12. And it sort of became an annual thing, people passing away. So if you made it through that first few years, you know, that's great. And then you'd get to about, I guess, your teen, pre-teens. Now, rightfully or wrongfully, this is my thought on it, is that when we go through puberty, boys and girls, our bodies go through so many changes. So, you know, CF, I just remember needing to have enough weight on me to help fight infections and to help my body go through this next phase of changes. And lung deterioration was huge back then. You know, we were often, there was one week I spent 16 weeks in hospital fighting an infection.
Oh my goodness.
So it was very common back then as well. When I say back then, you know, I'm 34 now. I'm talking when I was a kid, like 10, 11 year old, even younger and a little bit older. There was always a group of us with cystic fibrosis that would go in together. So we have this little family of CF kids, and we'd be in there for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Now, you know, my mum has, I've got my dad who's on dialysis. I've got a younger brother and sister. Mum would have to work. The hospital's in the city. We're half an hour, 45 minutes away. She couldn't be there with me 24/7. So from a young age, I had to learn to be pretty strong and fend for myself, I guess, in some way. But that's where the little CF family would help us. So we would grow up together and go through these things together. You know, you'd wake in the night and your mum wouldn't be there, and you'd have a needle that had come out of your arm because you'd accidentally ripped it out in the night. So you'd have to have another one put in, and you didn't have mum there to hold your hand. Like, it's really, yeah, quite traumatic, a lot of that stuff, if I think about it. But over every infection you get causes further lung damage. And there was just so many of us getting so sick all the time. And once you get to a point where you're that crook with your lungs, there's not much of a lung capacity left. So, you know, if you're listening and have a board while I'm talking, if you were to hold your nose for 30 seconds, pinch it tight, hold it with your fingers, breathe through that for 30 seconds, that's how it feels for someone to breathe with CF normally. Add having a cold into that, or another element of something from a lung capacity, lung breathing sort of, you know, angle, it's bloody hard. So the further our lungs were damaged, the further we'd deteriorate. And sadly, there were people that didn't make it because of that. I've had a lot of friends who probably up until our late teens had lung transplants, and sadly lungs rejected after a transplant. So you'd watch them, you know, deteriorate. Very sad, very heartbreaking. I mean, we've had lots of good times too, but this is the serious side, I guess, that people don't talk about. But so there's a thing called cross infection, and it's kind of funny because COVID, obviously, everyone's now accidentally aware of just how quickly bugs spread. Now, for us with CF, no, but it's so true, yeah. Isn't it? You think that did it take a pandemic to make the world clock on to something? So I've always had to use hand sanitizer. And if I'm sick, I've had to isolate for 2 weeks. I can't go out. I've had to wear masks. All this is normal for me. But what has happened is with CF people, we're not allowed to be around each other because one CF person might have a bug the other one doesn't have, and it can be a life-threatening bug, and it's been detrimental to the health. So growing up, we all grew up together. We're all getting each other's bugs, which just killed us probably even more. When I was about 12, I was taken from the hospital where we all grew up together and put in a hospital where I was the only CF patient. So I wasn't around that cross-infection at the time. And I think that probably saved me in some regard because I was able to fight the infection without having additional CF bugs and other things, you know, impact me. And I always think of the song by Miley Cyrus, The Climb, because I think I made it to the top and I feel very blessed. My sick isn't the same as other people's sick, but then someone else's healthy isn't my healthy. So it's about accepting that CF, whilst it is life-threatening and affects everyone, I think I'm probably a bit of living proof that, yes, I've had days where I am absolutely weeks, months, you know, I've had it. I mean, and just not being able to get better. I mean, only recently it took me a lot to swallow my pride, but I ended up having my needle put back in and I've had 2 weeks of intravenous antibiotics because I just could not fight the infection anymore. My body, I could barely breathe. And even now talking, I sound quite hoarse. I can get quite short of breath, and I'm someone that goes to the gym every day and, you know, tries to keep myself quite active and healthy and keep quite fit. But CF just has a funny way of just really smacking you on the head when you don't want it to. So I think, why am I here still talking to you? I think I'm determined and I guess lucky in some way. I'm compliant, but in a different way as well. I've never been bubble wrapped and mum never sort of said, you can't do that. You can't be out here. You're going to catch bugs. I was always, my immune system was built up. Hasn't always been easy, that's for sure. But, you know, I'm still here. And now I've got children, something that we didn't think was possible. Men with CF, I think it's about 98% of men with CF are infertile. And majority of women, there are a lot more women now I'm aware of that have CF and have children. But when I was, you know, in my early 20s, I knew that I wanted to have babies very quickly. And I think what I found is that there was not much encouragement for women with CF to have children. There was a lot of, you know, you Google it and it's, you know, horrific. And it was like, oh my God, why would you want to have a baby if you know you're not going to be here to see it grow up? And how's that going to affect you? And very morbid. So I created CF Mummy on Instagram. And I just thought I would do it just for the small community of people, just to sort of show, you know what, I've got CF, I'm pregnant, and this is how it's going to look. God knows what that would have looked like daily. But I wanted to share that with people because I'm pretty positive and can see, you know, I do have my bad days, don't get me wrong, but there is always a positive in the situation. So I wanted to create a platform that was authentic and real and show what it was like to be a mum, well, to be a pregnant CF woman. And then, you know, life after being pregnant, you're a mum. I'm a mum for the rest of my life now. I've earned that role. And it's not easy. You know, my kids, my heart breaks sometimes when I'm just, you know, we just had school holidays when I had my needle in and my heart breaks. I just had to lay there on the bed and I just didn't have energy. And thankfully they're only little still, but they get it. And I've got two empathetic, caring little souls that they're just, they're bloody crazy. They're like their mum. They're hypo and don't ever shut up. But that's kids, right? But yeah, you can never know. I don't know. I've got my point in telling you all that is I've got purpose more than ever now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a mum. I'm going to be, you know, a grandma, the glamorous grandma one day. And I've got purpose in that. So I now know last year I won the Australian of the Year, South Australian Local Hero. And that was recognising the work I do within the CF community and beyond, which I don't know who nominated me, but what that award allowed me to do is accept that I, you know, my story's a bit out there. I haven't even probably told you half of it, but I raise awareness. I raise money for CF, for the research. I put myself out there. I want to help others. I want to show others that it doesn't define you. Yes, it's going to affect you in some ways, but it doesn't, my life does not revolve around cystic fibrosis. It's merely a part of who I am, but it's not who I am. So I learned from that award that I hold a flag, not just for people that have cystic fibrosis or those that are affected by it, but I actually hold a flag for a lot more people too with invisible illnesses and other things. Because if I can get up and get on with my day, you know, I do treatment every day. My nebulizers, I do them in the morning. I take over 40 tablets a day.
40?
Every time I eat, it works out to about 40 tablets a day. You have 6 to 8 tablets every meal.
Wow.
But that's life. If I don't do it, I'm going to deteriorate. So I'm really, you know, I think I hear it sometimes, tall poppy syndrome. It's quite a common thing, sadly. But you know what? If I can help make the difference in the life of one person every day or in the talks that I do motivational speaking now around Australia. I have done for a long time, actually, but probably more so now that I believe in what I do and believe that I'm going to make a difference. And it works. You know, I'm not telling you a quote from someone. I'm telling you what I've gone through and how I've gotten over it. And, man, that's, you know, that makes an impact. So I have purpose now, you know. I really wanted to when I was a kid. Quick story. I remember Googling cystic fibrosis women because I wanted to look up to another CF woman. I wanted someone who had what I had that was doing something cool. There was never anything. And I knew from a young age that I had to change that. So now if you Google Emma Money, guess who pops up and guess who's written a book and guess who's done this. And I'm a game changer, but I'll help you as well if I can in whatever way that is. So I've created CF Mummy that's grown and I'm really proud of where that's going. And, you know, there's all kinds of fun things that come along with being CF Mummy. But Yeah, I'm really proud of that.
That's incredible. And congratulations on everything you've done. Wow, and winning that award.
Thank
incredible.
You. Yeah.
What has been the response to all of this from people?
I get asked, do I get like hate things, people being negative? And you've got to be careful. You know, even what I'm telling you today, I've had to learn to be careful in how much I give away to people because I'm a person too and I have feelings. And whilst you might not agree with everything, everyone's entitled to an opinion. So I think from being authentic and just myself and having, I've had people on my journey with me for a long time and sort of see me go through, you know, I'm divorced and gone through that, become, you know, the year I got divorced, I became a single mum and I got influenza A, which nearly killed me. So I really struggled, but I've had people follow me and see me be raw and authentic with that. Yeah. And I think that's really helped build that crowd. Like, do you know what I mean? I'm not just putting a, if I put a picture on Instagram up and I'm in my activewear, because, you know, I love my activewear and I love a good selfie, but there's a reason behind that. Why I've gone to the gym that day, it's because, you know, my lungs feel terrible, but guess what? I've still got up and I've still done that. As I say this, I didn't go to the gym today because I just slept through. But the response has been amazing. I'm really lucky. I've had people from all over the world reach out that have seen my name come up or that have been inspired by my story, or newly diagnosed mums that are like, thank you, giving me hope. And if I can give someone hope when they're holding that new baby in their hand, like, that's amazing. But, yeah, I think just by being authentic and me, scary or not. Funny story, though. I have so many stories, but I was filming a TV show on the weekend and it's going to be on Channel 7 in January. And we were on set from, like, 3 in the afternoon. I didn't get home, I think, till about 4, 5 a.m. the next morning. So it was a long day, right? But what I laugh at now is I could only hide my personality so much. When you're on set for that long and you're bloody tired, the quirkiness came out and I had so much fun. And I thought, right, everyone that watches that show is going to see what CF Mummy is like, not just what I'm choosing to show you, yeah, because I was me. And I'm actually not a bad person. That's pretty funny, apparently.
Of course not.
Do you know what I mean? We always have an idea of who we are or what we do and, I'm excited for that to come out. But do you know what? I think just being positive and being myself. And like I said, I don't share everything because I'm very careful of that. The year that I won a national magazine competition the year I found my birth parents. And, you know, it was Australia-wide competition. I was on Sunrise. I was on a lot of TV shows. Everyone knew who knew my story. And then we were put on the Australian Story on the ABC. You could Google that transcript, actually. It's called Girl in the Mirror. And that was the show, and it was about meeting my birth family, how that all unfolded. But then that same year, I published my first ever book, The Words Inside. And I've never reread the book.
You haven't?
No, it's quite traumatic in some ways. I don't know if anyone journals, but, I mean, I used to journal everything. And when I wrote the book, I was very open about being bullied through school. I was talked about the lives of people that I'd lost. You know, I remember one chapter writing this line. It was along the lines of, I opened the car door to have this woman run up to me and grab me and hold me and squeeze me. And she had long black hair and she was just crying, my baby, my baby. That was enough for me to not read that book again. I don't want to do it. And I'm writing my second book at the moment. It's been, you know, 15 plus years in the making. It's like a sequel to it. But I'm struggling a little bit because it's quite an emotional thing having to talk about stuff that, I mean, we all love to be a fly on the wall, but when you're writing about stuff in your own life that was quite eventful, you know, from the day I found out I was pregnant to separating and all of that, and it's all part of where I am. So when I share things with people, I'm just mindful of protecting my own self because I didn't when I was younger, and that left me very vulnerable.
Yeah, of course.
So I'll share what I share, but, you know, that's never the whole story, as much as it may sound like
people
it.
These days can be quite judgy too, I found, want their opinion about everything. But really, yeah, you share what you want to share and, yeah, it's your life, no one else's.
That's it. And if, you know what, if anyone can take anything from my life in a positive way, I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing. So, and it's working so far. How many people can say they won the Australian of the Year local hero for their state?
Exactly, exactly.
Me. And I'm proud
of
it.
Done everything else that you've done. You have been as well. Another thing I noticed you were doing is lobbying the government for different CF drugs to be on the PBS. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So the biggest one that I really was involved with was Orkambi. Now, Orkambi is a tablet, right? Two tablets, cost about $300,000 per script.
What?
For this drug. Yeah. Oh. Now, this drug is life-changing. There was results for people that had been on Orkambi saying how much their lives had improved. And I didn't really think too much into it in the beginning. Now, Orkambi was a three-year battle with the government where we kept fighting to have it put on the pharmaceutical benefit scheme in order to have it affordable. So that meant it would be a $6 script basically, mm-hmm. rather than $300,000. So I was one of many within the Australian CF community that really rallied. But, you know, we did things like me in particular wrote to our health minister, Greg Hunt, every day. I would, you know, share surveys. I would get the media involved. I think we did a couple of protests, and it was all just self-organized, and you'd get your army behind you to help support you. And I just remember I just had my son, and my daughter was so she would have been 2.5, and my son was only a few weeks old. And I remember I was so crook laying on the couch reading something about Orkambi, and I thought, I feel like someone, the government at this point, was holding a gun to my head and they had their finger on the trigger. Now, if they didn't let us have Orkambi, I just remember thinking they may as well just shoot us, because we became a number. And I'm thinking, I'm a mother sitting here with my children. I'm too sick to get up and be a mum, but there's a drug that I'm having dangled in front of me that's completely out of reach, but it's going to give me life. I just couldn't understand why we couldn't have it. So 3 years later, we got Orkambi listed, and it completely changed my life. I felt like I could take the really deep breath in, you know, from the bottom of my stomach, really go and breathe. And even doing it now, I'm not coughing. I couldn't do that. Things that I could do in a week, I can do in a day. So Orkambi, the best way to explain it, has helped slow things down and, you know, given me a new zest on life. And yeah, so that was a really good outcome. There's another drug we're fighting for at the moment, and it breaks my heart that every time we get it, almost we think we've had all these people doing surveys with us and people are sharing it on social media, it's, you know, rejected time and time again. The government won't approve it. So we're fighting for this one, Trikafta, at the moment. Now, this one, the Orkambi wasn't for every CF person because there's different genotypes, but Trikafta is for everyone. Like, everyone would be eligible to have a trial and see if it fits with their health. So, yeah, I was very that's what we're fighting for at the moment. So I think December it goes to the agenda for the government to review, but we've had it knocked back that many times. It's just ludicrous, really. You think there's a drug out there that is available to help better the lives of people. Why can't we have it? I don't understand. It's not rocket science. Yeah, there's a price on it, but, you know, we're not just a number. We're not a population number. We're a person, and we're a wife, mother, sister, brother, you know. It's hard. But that taught me about being persistent and never giving up, and eventually we won. So that gives me hope for this battle. I've probably taken a little bit of a step back with this one. I'm still protesting and getting as much out there as I can, but it's heartbreaking to know that that's not really happening right now. So I did meet Scott Morrison when I won the Australian of the Year award, the local hero. I say that because I didn't win Australian of the Year. My title's quite a long title, but I did meet him at his home. We got to go there for breakfast, and I did say to him, if I need a favor, I'm coming for you. So I think I need to probably seriously take that up, because he said, I'll remember. So I think it might be time I hit up ScoMo for that favour.
So with these drugs, I'm presuming then, is that then mean that the life expectancy would get higher? And obviously the quality of life is going to get better for people with cystic fibrosis?
Absolutely. Yep. It basically, I'm trying to think how many, let me think. Well, look at me, for example, with my Orkambi, it slowed me down. Like I said, I'm doing things in a day that I would do in a week. I can get up and run around now. I can go to the gym. exercise. The exercise, I say I go to the gym every day. That helps move all the mucus off my lungs and helps keep my airways clear. So if you imagine bugs sitting on the top of your lungs, if you just didn't do anything, it would just grow and be worse in your lungs. But by going to the gym, I'm able to move it out most days. And then it's also good mentally. Oh, mental-wise, mental health is such a big thing. Whoever you are, wherever you are, you know, mental health is huge. So for me, exercise has been a really good therapy for that.
Yeah, I can only imagine how incredibly challenging it must be to have a condition like yours and see, especially as a kid, seeing other people passing away because of it, how traumatizing that must be.
Yeah.
To deal with.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it.
It's hard, but you know what? A short story for you of the ultimate, I guess, resilience and whatever word you can come up with yourself, you know, think about. But last year, obviously COVID happened, and my dad, like I said before, he's a paraplegic, one leg, one hip, no kidneys, dialyzed 3 times a week. He was in a taxi going to the hospital to have dialysis one morning, and he was in an access cab, which is a wheelchair cab that could allow his chair to go in. The taxi driver fell asleep for a second and braked. Dad yelled out, "Stop, stop." He braked. Dad catapulted out of the chair and snapped the one leg he did have. The femur bone completely snapped. Now, without going into it all, because it's still very raw for our family, Dad ended up having his leg amputated. And most of last year, my dad was spent hospitalized. He had to go to rehabilitation. You know, we nearly lost him. We did lose him mentally for a long time. He was like a lost person in a body. There was no dad. Christmas, he was in intensive care. It's been very traumatic. And then this year, he's only recently, I won't go into it all, but in May, it was May the 13th, we put Dad on life support. He was in hospital. He'd been in there for 9+ weeks. He had fluid on his lung, pneumonia, everything and everything wrong with him. But it was really horrible, you know, watching him suffering, and he still wanted to be here. Like, he still knew that he had to be here. And despite what was going on, watching him suffer, he was hallucinating. He didn't know things that were real or not real. 13th of May, we put him on life support, and that was horrible, having to watch that decision be made very quickly. And basically my sister was holding my dad's face saying, "We're going to be here, Dad, the whole time. You just need to go to sleep for a little while so your body can fight these infections," because he just wasn't getting better. And I remember my sister, just her hands were cupped around his face, and my mum crying, and I'm there like, what the F is happening right now? And we got basically like peeled off of him. And within a blink of an eye, that room, there was like 25, 30 intensive care staff tending to Dad. And within, you know, half an hour, we're in the waiting room. Within half an hour, he was not there anymore, in the way of he was breathing with a machine. And going back in and watching him, it was horrible. It was really horrible. And then the 15th of May, his birthday, oh my God, he woke up. He's home now. So he's home. But, you know, Dad is the ultimate, like, his story is ridiculous. And he has just time and time again, you know, he's so resilient. He's overcome so much in his life. And yeah, that's very traumatic for us still. I mean, life is so precious. You know, last week, again, this is how crazy it is. And there's never a dull moment in the money family, mm-hmm. so to speak. You know, Monday morning rolls around and Dad ends up in intensive care again. But then, but then within a few days he's home and he's gone out for dinner last night with Mum. But this time last week he's in ICU. Tough. I'm just like, what? Like, we cannot handle this anymore, Dad. Yeah. But life is precious, and, you know, he is amazing. And I talk a lot about my dad when I do speak in events and, you know, my workshops and things, because there's a lot of lessons to be learned from him. And if there's one person that I've always looked up to and sought inspiration from, it's my dad, and that will never change.
That's amazing. He sounds absolutely amazing. Wow. What a
person. He is. He really is.
And what a dad to learn from too, for you.
Oh, incredible. I know. We do laugh because he's brown, like very brown, and I'm not, unless I've been in the sun. And he's just got this beautiful white smile and just such a nice, you know, presence about him. And yeah, I'm very lucky, very, very lucky.
Oh, it's fantastic. And I'm glad to hear that he's okay now.
I know. It's definitely been traumatic, that's for sure. But life is, you never know what's around the corner.
So what do you hope for your future?
I want to be here for a very long time. I want a cure, I think, to be found. I say I think because realistically, is a cure for CF going to be found? I don't know. I'm an ambassador for the Cure for CF Foundation, and we fund research that's being done to find a cure. And I do believe that CF, cystic fibrosis, will stand for cure found one day.
Oh, I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I always thought that. And I'm like, I think that's a thing. But to be honest, I think now I've got two beautiful children. I just want to live a happy, fulfilled life. I want to give them the best life that I can. I want to enjoy things, you know. I want to enjoy the now, enjoy the opportunities that come my way, and continue to create things that people thought that's not possible, and push boundaries. And I've learned in my life that life is precious and life is short, so appreciate the small things. Do that. Spend that $50 on that thing that you shouldn't have spent it on, or you just never know when your time's up. So for me, I'm finally in a place where I think I'm quite content, and my work is very busy, and I'm happy, and yeah, it's good. So happy and healthy, that's as much as we can ask for, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I have one final question that I ask everyone at the end of their interviews. If you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Ooh, one piece of advice. Don't sweat the small stuff. Simple, but I think there was too many times I would worry about things that were not in my control. So maybe worry about what's in your control, you know. Don't sweat the small things. Because I think I probably spent a lot of time, yeah, I'm a list person. So I would remember where I would write lists to go, right, this is what's in your control, this wasn't in your control. And then from that, I would eliminate the what's not in my control out of the equation and work through the list that is in my control and prioritize things. So make things, you know, easy for you. Don't overcomplicate it. Simple.
Thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story. It's been absolutely lovely to meet you and speak with you.
Yeah, likewise.
And hopefully that drug will be available soon for you.
Fingers crossed, hey? Fingers crossed we can touch base in a year on the show and I'll tell you that I've been on it.
Yeah, it'll all be changed.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inspirational Tales. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you could please share it with your family and friends so that we can inspire more people. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please don't forget to leave us a rating or a review, and make sure that you have subscribed or followed the podcast on whichever platform that you are listening to it on so that you can stay up to date as new episodes are released. Thanks again, and I look forward to you joining me for the next episode of Inspirational Tales.